Welcome back. This is part two. If you are not listening to these back to back, we were just in the middle of a discussion with Ian Buchanan. He was bringing up the notion of territory, literal territory, and how we might rethink notions of hospitality. And that could be a measure of deterritorializing desire, particularly in colonial settler states where, as a settler, if you're a settler, your desire is still complicit in that arrangement or that state of affairs. But deterritorializing also has to do with mental territories. And that's what we're going to move into now. So here's your quick recap. This picks up right off the end of that. And we're going to continue our discussion on the Pill Pod with Ian Buchanan. All right. So at this point, we're talking doubly about literal territories. And in this case, these literal territories are also conceptual categories having been written into laws and things like that. Then do you think this would be a good time to try to define deterritorialization and territorialization? Because these are both central concepts to the chapter that I read today, The Refrain. How you would use those contexts to actually, I guess, rearticulate kind of what you just said. But how? What is the importance of these concepts in being a thinker as well as being a political actor?
So I think the first thing is that for Deleuze and Guattari, the notion of territory is not necessarily coextensive with a particular space. So they take it from, I mean, there's various points of origin, but if we look at the sort of ethological points of origin, which they take out of animal behavioral studies, what is crucial about the idea of territory within animal behavioral studies is the sense of a kind of subjective position with respect to space. Like, this is my space, and as Deleuze and Guattari say, my territory is the space in which I feel at home. Okay, and if somebody comes into my space, I recognize and I experience them as an intruder. But not everybody is experienced that way. So if somebody that I like comes into my space, I don't regard them as an intruder. I see them as kind of helping me to produce the space in which I live. They become part of my territory. So the idea then of deterritorialization is effectively to be expelled from, or to expel oneself from, the space in which you feel at home. Now, why might you do that on a sort of personal level? One of the things that Guattari always talks about through his kind of idea of therapy, he says that we should be able to move between territories, you know, the territory of the home, the territory of work, and that sort of thing, and that there should be a kind of seamless movement between these different territories. But sometimes for, you know, various complicated reasons, we can get stuck in a particular territory, and we find ourselves unable to leave that territory. And so that would be like, you know, I feel at home in my home space. And whenever I leave my home, I feel like I'm kind of away from home. But also, like, when I go into work, I treat everybody as though somehow they're invading my home. And so I haven't actually, you know, changed territories at all. I've just taken my territory with me. And obviously that creates all kinds of problems. So deterritorialization in that sense is, how does one leave one's territory? How does one find a way of moving on to other kinds of territories? So it's not intrinsically negative. In fact, for Deleuze and Guattari, it's necessary in lots of ways. If I become stuck on my racist values, how do I extricate myself from those values? What would it take to leave that territory? So the other way we can think about territory is the set of values, a set of beliefs, a set of ideas in which I feel at home. And these can be absolutely incoherent, right? And, you know, when we're doing a sort of analysis of racism, I think what's really interesting is to try to understand racism as a form of territory in which people feel at home, and to ask the question, well, why do you feel at home in those sets of values? And what's really interesting is that when you push people on those values, they are, you know, both rock solid that they won't leave them because they feel comfortable, but they're also, and they seem to know that they are incoherent. Like, I hate all black people, but my black neighbor is okay. So there is, you know, there's just no coherence in that, and it lacks all kinds of conviction. So how would you actually analyze that except to say, well, there is something about this set of values that enables this person to function in the world that they do. And so how would we deterritorialize them? How would we give them a new set of values that would enable them to feel at home, but feel at home in a way that did not necessitate this kind of proliferation and production of kind of statements of hate and so on? And, you know, Deleuze Guattari was saying, well, you know, that process is slow. You can't deterritorialize too rapidly because then people, you know, feel like they don't have a home anywhere at all, and often that makes them even more violent. So it's a slow process. And that process they refer to as re-territorialization, give them the new home to feel on. And I think what you see, you know, with Trump and so forth, and like I think, I always think that the American elections are so important, you know, the rest of us should be allowed to vote too, because clearly the Americans don't want to vote. Like, fuck, this matters. Let us vote too. We'll show you the right way to go. I mean, obviously, that's just a crazy aside, but I do think that the power of America is such that we can't just leave it up to the Americans to make these decisions. But, you know, if you think about, you know, Trump as this kind of how on earth did he actually get elected, and, you know, you drill down into it and you think, well, why on earth would blue-collar workers, or even more kind of amazingly out-of-work blue-collar workers, why would they vote for someone like Trump who clearly has expressed zero interest in their future at all and will literally do nothing to help them? How can we possibly explain that? And so this comes back to, you know, getting back to your earlier questions about Marxism and so forth, that we can't really understand these kinds of questions if we think about them solely in terms of interest. Because clearly it is not in their interest to vote for Trump if you think, I'm voting for the guy who will get me a job and so on. If we think about it that way, it doesn't make any sense. But if we think about it in terms of, well, what kinds of values is Trump espousing that might matter to somebody who's feeling disenfranchised and you know, kind of disengaged from the world? Well, he's saying things about making America great. He's saying things about the priority of America over everybody else. And those values suddenly become quite attractive. So you can't understand it in terms of straightforward, you know, financial interest. You have to start to understand it in terms of cultural values. And for me, that's where desire comes into it. So I think that, you know, if we wanted to understand the present situation, we have to bring desire into that equation.
Chris, do you want to respond to that before I ask my next question? Do you have a thought or no? Like, I'm not putting you on the spot.
No. I see this from the opposite side because when I was writing on Deleuze, I got criticized by a lot of thinkers that see Deleuze as apolitical. So, I mean, the Peter Hallwards, the Zizek's, the Badiou, and you always hear that fantastic story about Badiou smashing through with his Maoist friends into Deleuze's class and Deleuze just kind of dismissing him. You know, I'm teaching, please leave my
room. For context, that was in May 68, right?
That was in 68, yes. And Badiou actually wrote a paper called The Fascism of the Potato in 73. No, I'm not even joking about all of this stuff with Deleuze. And so, like, my one question, because I struggled with this, I have to admit, I struggled with this because, you know, we have a lot of friends that are very Hegelian Marxists. And I never saw the clear link with Marx and Deleuze, actually. I mean, Derrida famously stated at his funeral, you know, Deleuze was a Marxist, or he was one of the good Marxists or something like that. But then you have Badiou writing a book like The Adventures in French Philosophy and putting Deleuze in the map where fascism is with Althusser and stuff like that. So, I mean, how do you approach people, or how do you approach these other thinkers like Hallward and Zizek and Badiou and even Rancière, who was, I think, was a friend of Deleuze, but wrote, you know, kind of not exactly the nicest remarks about his work. So how do you deal with this apolitical accusation against Deleuze and Deleuzians? Ian?
Look, I mean, I think I always thought that I've never asked Peter about this, but I always thought Peter only wrote that book as a kind of a deal with Verso so that they would publish these other books on Haiti and so forth.
You heard it here first.
I mean, Peter may think that that's completely off base and maybe it is. But it's a very weak critique of Deleuze. It's such a weak critique of Deleuze that most people haven't bothered to even repudiate it. Zizek's critiques of Deleuze show evidence that he never actually read Deleuze. So again, they're not even worth repudiating. They're just absolute crap. And, you know, if you read enough Zizek, which, you know, for my sins I have done, after a while, not only is it clear that he never read Deleuze and Guattari and has no intention of reading Deleuze and Guattari, he quotes them at least as often approvingly as disapprovingly. So there's literally, you know, as my kids always say, no consistency. And, you know, as for Badiou, I mean, there's so much bad faith there. It's just ridiculous. Like his book on Foucault, on Deleuze, comes across as somebody who's just kind of pissed off that Deleuze wouldn't talk to him anymore. Like it's this sort of spoiled child book.
Just for aside for the readers, they were writing letters from 83 to 86, and Deleuze said he didn't want them published, and then instead Badiou went and took the letters and wrote the book, The Clamor of Being. Sorry, I didn't take.
This is hot, so go off, Ian, go off.
Well, I mean, you know, Deleuze said to Badiou apparently that he didn't want to continue the correspondence anymore. He felt that he'd said everything he wanted to say. And you can sort of imagine what that conversation went like, you know, something along the lines of, oh, look, Badiou, you obviously are not listening to me. You know, I don't see any point in this conversation continuing because it's just pointless. And, you know, Badiou's response to that was to sort of come up with all this sort of bogus discussion of ontology, that somehow Deleuze's ontology, because he believed in a univocity of being, somehow meant that he believed in totalitarianism and something like that. I mean, as a leap of thought, like, you know, you would tell off a grad student for coming out with that bullshit. You'd be like, what on earth is this? You know, how would you expect your advisors to respond to a claim like that? So I've never felt that much need to respond to Badiou's responses to Deleuze. They just seem idiotic. And so I think that the whole critique and the other one that everyone trots out, oh, Deleuze wasn't political until he met Guattari, and this is Zizek's line, then he became too political. I mean, what kind of idiotic idea is that? I mean, it's completely false to begin with. If you read Deleuze's earlier works, they're clearly political in the sense of trying to develop an ontology that helps you to understand the current state of affairs. And also, you know, the idea that he only becomes political in relationship to Guattari is completely false. Because if Guattari was as political as everybody makes him out to be, why on earth would he have wanted to talk to Deleuze if Deleuze was as apolitical as everybody makes him out to be? It's like, I know the one person I really want to talk to is the most apolitical person in France.
And write four books with him or whatever it was.
Yeah. So it just doesn't make any kind of sense. Like it's clearly bogus. It's a story that people have conjured up that sounds kind of good. So I think really what is much more likely to be true is that they both had political leanings and ideas and sympathies, and they saw a convergence of those ideas. But more importantly, they saw an intensification of them as they came together.
All right. So we've done our dunking, which I'm very happy about. That gives us sound bites.
All right. Well, you know, it is my forte of trashing.
We've done
people.
Our dunking. And I want to move right before we go to the refrain, if that's the direction we're headed. I like how this conversation is developing rhizomatically or organically in any case. But when we move into the last book that Deleuze and Guattari wrote together, What is Philosophy? Then this, what you're talking about in terms of reterritorialization and not state smashing, but thinking within a state of affairs that you're not going to be able to change, like with your humanist individual agency as a locus. And I think this applies to not just people who want to be philosophers, but artists, political subjects who want to be effective as political subjects. And that's the notion of creativity. They talk about shooting off lines of flight. And really, when you get to what is philosophy, there's almost an unction, almost like if you hear us say one thing, it's do this, be creative, don't box yourself in, don't stick to one territory, become nomadic, and all these sort of unctions to remake yourself. And how would you reflect on that as sort of their certainly not anti-political, as we were just discussing, But how do you see this as their goal for not just thinking philosophers in academics, but for people to become creative or make themselves creative?
Right. So I think that in the introduction to the book, Deleuze and Guattari basically say that, you know, things have gotten bad when we start talking about people working in marketing as being creative, that this is not true creativity. This is barbarians at the gate. So there is a kind of defensiveness about this book, which is quite different from their previous collaborations. And so it does a number of things, but one of the things it wants to try to do is to identify what we might think of as being like, this is what authentic, genuine, scholarly, creative work looks like, as opposed to marketing and something else. And so it's almost as if, and maybe this was in fact the impetus, that Deleuze and Guattari were trying to defend the university and the idea of the university against the encroachments of neoliberalism, which luckily for them, they never had to experience in terms of what universities look like now compared to what they look like when Deleuze was still working in a university, which he retired in like 87 or something. Because I was a grad student starting about the time that he retired. And already then people were saying, oh, the good old days, which no longer existed in 87. And I find myself telling my graduate students now, oh, the good old days of the 1980s, which people at the time thought were horrendous. They thought this was the end of everything that's holy. So there is a sense in which what Deleuze and Guattari were kind of recognizing was the profound interference into the university by the state in the form of trying to turn it into something that was about marketing, that was about business, that was creativity on demand, that was a kind of instrumentalized form of scholarship, and all of those things. And he's clearly, Deleuze and Guattari are clearly trying to carve out a space and says, well, this is what authentic scholarship and creativity looks like. There is a set of values associated with that which are really worth defending, and we should defend them against the intrusions of the market, of the state, and so on. And I think that aspect of the book has never really been recognized and talked about enough, perhaps because at the time it was only the early days of these kinds of intrusions. But, you know, as I look at what's happening in the university sector globally now, you really can appreciate just how much they wanted to defend things that seem under real threat of extinction right now. So even though they are talking about creativity, they are also trying to say, and this is the other thing that's really interesting in this book, there is a really kind of concerted attempt to say, this is what is different about the sciences from the arts and from philosophy, that they are doing quite distinct things, and that we should try to recognize those differences and see that the job of creativity is not to extinguish those differences, but to get a kind of creative interference. And so that's what they talk about in the conclusion of the book, that actually what's really interesting, but what we also have to defend against, is the interference, the gaps between science, philosophy, and art, where one bleeds into the other and loses all distinctiveness. And that might sound like a kind of hypothetical problem, but I can tell you that at my own university and many universities around the world, they have all these kind of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary research funds, which give money to groups that can say, well, you know, we've got someone from the arts, someone from engineering, someone from biology, someone from somewhere else, and now we're going to do all this kind of work together. But the principle of that work is that there is no intrinsic difference between what they all do. And so therefore there is a kind of profound de-skilling of the individuals involved, and also a sort of a de-specialization. So you do creative arts, well, that's kind of like engineering, so, you know, you can work together, or you're an engineer that's creative, so therefore we, you know, and eventually what you find happens is engineers are doing creative work, so therefore we don't actually need creative artists anymore because, you know, they're just superfluous. Engineers are already creative. You know, marketing is already doing philosophy, so we don't really need philosophers anymore because they're superfluous and they don't bring any money in, so let's get
it. It sounds like the MIT research lab where they, I don't know, grow leaves out of skin in a, and then put it up on the wall and call it art.
Right, right. And that's what's happening. But I think what Deleuze and Guattari recognized before any of us was that this would lead to the extinction of whole branches and fields of scholarly enterprise, and that we would all be the poorer for it, because what we don't need is the synthesis of all these things. What we need is the interferences between the differences.
This is not really an unction for just everybody to go, you know, write a book of poetry and self-publish it, but it's more like defending probably philosophy specifically and the arts, because they're the most under threat from the middle term of those, which is the sciences that he was writing about. Is that more accurate to say?
I don't think he regards the sciences as being
no.
I think it's pretty clearly that it's marketing and it's capitalism. Like, the sciences are under just as much threat as well. I mean, look at, you know, America's spectacular failure to deal with COVID, and it's not because they don't have smart scientists. They got loads of them. You know, some of the smartest scientists in the world work in the US, but they're kind of separated from government and separated from being able to apply any intelligence to the issues in front of them by a whole bunch of structures that have arisen out of capitalism. So it's pretty clear that capitalism, marketing, et cetera, that's the enemy, and that all the scholarly fields are under threat.
We could mention that what's it, East England, the East England School of Philosophy is being shut down?
Yeah, just, you know, one among many that have been, you know, sacrificed to the greater God.
But do you think that science or STEM programs are at any risk of being shut down? Because I find that in the budgets I look at, including the budgets of the school that Chris and I have taught at, that's not at all the case.
Like, it doesn't look like it's the case, because they get money thrown at them because, you know, everybody wants the cure for cancer and everybody wants, you know, some fabulous new material or some fabulous new computer part and so forth. So it doesn't look like they're under any kind of a threat. But if you look at how that funding is channeled towards them, a great deal of it, particularly in the sciences, comes from private corporations, which then means that their research is compromised from the outset, that they're basically doing instrumental research for a corporation. They're not just doing pure research for the hell of it. You know, we want to find out what this particle does because that would be interesting. They're doing, we need to figure out how to do this in order to make a better supercomputer because, you know, Microsoft wanted or whatever. So they're compromised in different ways. They look like they have pots of money, which often they do, but those monies are kind of golden manacles.
Can I ask you just a quick question? Because this is one of my concerns with what is philosophy. Just about, you know, it seems like a manifesto for creators to create. But sometimes it seems like Deleuze is just talking about arbitrarily just creating for the sake of creating. So how do you differentiate between arbitrarily creating something and creating something that's necessary to, to kind of, as he says, you know, make the stutter or shake the status quo?
I guess what he's saying is something like this. Creativity is important, but genuine creativity is difficult to the point of almost impossible, and genuinely new things happen extremely rarely. So we produce lots of things through a creative process that are in some way a replication of what already exists, which is not to dismiss it. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's unimportant or uninteresting, but it hasn't risen to the level of genuinely creative. And so I think that there is a kind of very, very high bar put in place in what Deleuze and Guattari are saying about what does creativity look like. Like, it's really hard to achieve this level of creativity. And so they're saying, you know, it's only by bringing something new into the world that we're actually creative. But I think this has a kind of political resonance because, if you go back to what I was saying before about the impossibility of revolution and insurrection and so forth, to bring about a genuinely new way of thinking about the world, it's obviously really difficult. There are so many kind of forces and powers arrayed against novelty within political ideas, and more importantly, novelty within the kind of application of political ideas. They're actually, to bring about that transformation is an extremely powerful kind of an event, and something that, you know, we would all, want to try to figure out how to do. And this is the one thing that Badiou does say, which is kind of interesting, around politics, is the idea of conviction. And he says that a political idea should be as kind of impossible to argue with as a mathematical formula, which on the one hand sounds kind of stupid, but on the other hand, if you think about what a mathematical formula is, it's like you can't argue with it, right? Like 2 + 2 = 4, and you can debate that all you want, but at the end of the day, it's still going to equal 4. So if you were able to produce a political idea that was as lucid as an impossible to argue with that, like, you know, that people ought to have a living wage, for example, if that could be as lucid as a mathematical formula, how powerful would that be from a political point of view? And that's what we're struggling against. Like, we can't seem to produce those ideas easily that just simply have that level of traction. And I think that's where our creativity is called upon.
And speaking of creation and the creation of concepts, which is the job of the philosopher, Ian, I don't know if you know where this is said or if it was said at all or if I made it up and pretend that I had read it somewhere. But did Deleuze say that his only real original concept, despite all the ones that are associated with him, you know, body without organs, the territories, the plateaus, all of these are sort of transposed from other thinkers. But did he say that his one concept that he had created was the refrain?
Not just him, he and Guattari, but yes.
But did they say that specifically?
Yes, they do say that. This is the thing we created, and we think that's our most important contribution.
Do you know where? Because I've been looking for this quote all day.
It's in either the Desert Islands or the other collection of essays.
Okay, I'll try to.
If you send me an email, I will be able to find it for you. I can't, off the top of my head, tell you where it is. It's either in that one or the Two Regimes of Madness. It's in one of those two, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I would be able to find.
Okay, so
quote.
The refrain. I know your book deals with the refrain, so I'd like to take a little bit to first of all discuss what the refrain is, just in case you look this up in the dictionary. The refrain is like a chorus in music, or a repeated line in poetry, or even a motif reproduced across a painting. So a refrain, something that is repeated. And do you want to talk about this in with respect to your work, or what you're currently been thinking about and presumably spending a lot of time on, Ian?
Sure. So the best way to think about the refrain is to see that the refrain is something that is produced through the repetition of material things, so whether it's sounds or images or whatever. But in fact, the refrain is that kind of synthesis of those things, like the impossible to reproduce or to think otherwise. Like if you think about a chord, you're playing like three notes at the same time. You can't achieve that thing except by doing all those things all at once. So the refrain is what happens when you produce certain kinds of repetitions. And what I think Deleuze and Guattari are particularly interested in is the kind of internal necessity that comes about through the production of the refrain. So, you know, if you're thinking about this in musical terms, and you're thinking like you're whistling a tune or whatever, and you think, well, you know, what should the next note be? And what would be possible and what would be impossible? And then if you ask yourself, well, how on earth do I know what is possible and what is impossible? Because surely in the grand scheme of things, I can drop in any note that I want, but you would know that that was not true. Like if you put in some notes, they're just going to be completely wrong. The whole thing's going to fall apart. It's not going to work.
It would just sound discordant, right? It would sound wrong, even if you don't know anything about music.
That's, yeah, literally discordant, right? So discordant means it's, yeah. And so if you're whistling something and you can, to yourself, you know what sounds right. And that's the refrain, right? The refrain is this kind of creation of something that then has its own internal necessity. And if you like, that's a way of thinking about immanence too, because when you're in the middle of that refrain, that is the structure, that's immanence, that is pure immanence. And that structure itself determines what comes next, what should be next. And that's the creative mentality. Like when you're in the zone, when people talk about being in the zone, then you kind of know what the next thing should be. And that's the refrain at work. It's the sheer imminence of that space that you have created through the repetition of certain kinds of notes and the creation of a structure that enables you to decide what should be next and what can't be next.
But I mean, I agree absolutely. But a lot of the musicians that Deleuze loves, Berg, Boulez, there's not a lot of repetition. There's a kind of a lot of free play, a lot of like the any space, whatever, the especially with Boulez, who he wrote a lot about Boulez.
But when he's talking about Boulez, repetition in music is not just simply the repetition of notes. It can also be the repetition of beats, right? So it can be the repetition of a particular structure, a sequencing of beats. And so musical composition has, and I'm by no means an expert, of course, but I know enough to know that musical composition has a number of different levels. But what's more important is the creation of a kind of internal necessity whereby you know what must come next and what cannot come next. And that is important. Like Boulez, you listen to his music, I'm not a huge fan, but nonetheless, when you're listening to it, you don't sort of expect that the next thing will be the sound of an asteroid hitting the Earth. You can kind of know what the next thing might be. So it has its internal necessity. It creates its own space of imminence that progresses and develops.
That makes a lot of sense because the one aspect where he starts talking about birdsong, about the, I forget the musician that does this, that writes whole songs as if, you know, copying the sound of birds. I can really see the internal necessity in regards to that. So,
and this concept of the refrain, he actually uses in the chapter an example of bird song as territorializing, which is another concept we've already mentioned today, in terms of what we talked about the other week, Chris, about vitalism and how action is not specifically human. He's also making a post-humanist philosophical move in the sense of saying this is not just a music item that humans invent, but birds use the refrain to mark territories. And it has this whole concept of not being associated with the eye and the ocular centrism of Western philosophy since Plato. It's saying let's think in audio terms or musical terms rather than thinking of forms and identities. So it seems like a really centralized concept that kind of unifies everything around it in a few ways.
Yeah, and that's certainly how they think of it. And it becomes so that the refrain then is the foundation of the concept of the territory. The territory, they say, is the first form of the concept of the assemblage. And the assemblage is the sort of the first form of later concepts that develop out of that, that kind of grow in scale and complexity. So, you know, if you wanted to find the kind of the grounding point for them, then it becomes this idea of the refrain. But they also connect that refrain to notions of desire because the refrain is a way of organizing desire. So within the kind of ethological context and birds and so forth, it's about mating rituals. But those mating rituals are also about saying, it's an invitation to somebody to join that particular territory, to be part of that same kind of way of thinking. It's also a kind of warning to all the other would-be competitors and contenders to stay away. So that desire is intrinsic in those kinds of sounds.
Yeah, and I can hear the birds outside declaring their territories at the moment. But if we move instead from, I guess, this ecological context in terms of, you know, bird song, what most people hear in terms of the refrain, and this will probably connect to your discussion of desire that you just made, but how does this connect to something like pop music, which uses the refrain in hooks and melody? This becomes very much integrated in your mind, right?
It's like super interesting to ask yourself, well, why is this song a hit and why is that song not a hit? Like, what is the difference in the quality of the way that song is produced versus that song that's produced? It's almost impossible to understand. And if you don't think about it just in terms of whether it's sold millions of copies or whatever, but think about it in terms of did it have a form of affective resonance such that, you know, 50 years later people are still singing that song and still, kind of developing memories and associations with that song? It's quite extraordinary. Like, it's really an extraordinary thing that our culture has produced. These, like, 3-minute pop songs, which we think of as being just, you know, kind of throwaway commercial things, but they're not. Like, they're an important part of the way by which we structure our memories and our desires in contemporary society. That's, for me, those are the kinds of refrains and questions that become really interesting. Well, how do those songs function to structure
memory, to structure desire, to structure the ways by which we communicate to each other and so on. And it's been like really interesting to see all the bans that have come out recently and wanted to prevent Trump from using their music. You know, so like Tom Petty's estate said, you can't use I Won't Back Down, and various other bands have done as well. And I was reading recently, apparently Buick offered the Doors a whole bunch of money in 1967 to use one of their songs to advertise their cars. And Jim Morrison said, if you do that, I'm going to buy a Buick and I'm going to publicly smash it and set it on fire and tell everybody what a shit car it is. And so they never used the Doors song, and basically Doors songs have never been used for commercial purposes since then. But, you know, it's not, we kind of think of that as being about the band's authenticity, and sure, that's part of it. But is it not also about a sort of stronger sense that these songs do have an incredible capacity to harness and to galvanize desire? And you know, Deleuze and Guattari explicitly say, you know, we march to our deaths on the tune of a song. There's something very powerful about this.
He loved Edith Piaf, right? I think I'm pronouncing her name right. He loved her pop songs, but he loved just the way that her voice would go off tune sometimes. Like he you see him kind of, his eyes kind of like light up when you bring up her.
Yeah, it's what Roland Barthes referred to as the grain of the voice.
So we've talked about this term in terms of music, which is what it's closest to, but it's also a concept for how to think philosophically and presumably how to write philosophically, because that's how you think. So what would be other applications that don't have to do with music or to do with writing or anything?
Right. So I can give you a different, completely different kind of example. I'm working with a colleague at my university, Gordon Waite, who's in human geography, and we've been working on a project relating to cycling. And so over the last month or so, we've been working on this article using the idea of the refrain and of territory to think about cycling. And so within that chapter on the refrain, they talk about this notion of critical distance. And so critical distance is the space between creatures of the same species and creatures of a different species. And what is the right distance between them? So like, you know, I guess the global pandemic has made us super conscious of what critical distance looks like, and we all get told to stay 1.5 meters or 2 meters away from people of our own species and so forth. Whereas previously we never used to think about that too much. But if we came up against a lion, we'd be like, well, you know, 2 meters is probably not enough distance. I want to be a lot further away. So if you think about this in terms of cycling, the way by which the regulation of traffic is organized in Australia, and also I rode around in Toronto a lot, and I was, people told me that riding in Toronto was scary, but I was like, this is a paradise compared to Australia.
We got lanes now. We got lanes on every street in downtown. So,
well, I was constantly shocked. I would be walking along and I'd get to an intersection and cars would stop to let me cross. Like in Australia, that doesn't happen. Cars do not stop to let you cross. If you want to cross, you wait for the lights to change or you just take your chances, but they certainly ain't going to stop. And so this idea of traffic then either treats all vehicles on the road as the same species, in which case then it's just a question of distance between them, or they're treated as a different species, which then produces a different set of problems, which is Deleuze and Guattari think about in terms of function, but for us are in terms of, well, whether or not you should be there or you shouldn't be there. So if they are of the same species, then to me, and this is the analogy I use in the paper, it's like saying it's perfectly fine to have the fox and the chickens in the same coop, because all you need to do is paint a white line down the middle of the coop and, you know, the chickens are going to be safe. We know that's completely false, but that's what they do with bikes, right? They've got trucks and buses and cars zooming along at 50, 60 kilometres an hour, and you've got a white line that's supposed to magically defend you from that, which you know it doesn't. You go across your line, you die. So that's a problem. Or alternatively, and this is more how it is in Australia, the position is rather something like, well, the chickens should never have been in the coop with the fox to begin with, because it was clearly the fox's coop and the chickens ought to have known that and they should never have been there. And if they get eaten by the fox, it was their own fault because they shouldn't have been there. And so in Australia, there's a real trajectory to try to push bikes off the road completely, not just onto separate lanes, but onto separate bike paths and ideally onto trails in the bush or something, but just, you know, get out of our way. And so for me, it's quite interesting to begin to think about the space of the road as a territory, because the founding question is, I think, false. If we assume that they're all just traffic, that's a false assumption. So therefore, if we don't assume that they're all traffic, but we ask ourselves, well, what is the actual state of relations between bikes and cars and trucks and buses? Then we realize that actually it's a predatory relation. It's a relation in which we acknowledge tacitly that the truck has right of way because it could kill us. Okay. And all our traffic laws are premised on this idea that the thing that can kill you should be given right of way. And that if you want to cross the road, then you're an idiot. You should keep out of the way of the truck. It should have priority because it's doing important work and whatever. So for me, this idea of the territory then becomes a way of questioning the foundations of something as basic as traffic.
All right. So we have two examples of refrains in process, and it seems to be something about the generation of patterns, either generation in your mind or the generation of complex human organizations. And you mentioned to me in our pre-discussion chat that you were focusing on this chapter a little bit in your book. So with the last little bit of time we have left, could you give us a preview of what your thesis is, what people can look forward to, and maybe how this concept of the refrain fits into the thesis that you're developing in that?
Yeah, so the book itself is about the idea of or the possibility of using the concept of the assemblage to do forms of cultural analysis and critical work. I talk about the idea of the territory as one of the ways by which the assemblage presents to us. And I use the example of the kids' film Cars, which maybe you have seen or maybe not, but I must have seen it about 100 times.
We both have nieces and nephews, so I think we've both seen it too.
Yes.
When that film came out, my son was about 3 or 4, and he absolutely loved that movie. So I got to watch it many, many times. But I remember at the time, I mean, I quite like the movie. There's lots that's good about it. But what was really striking to me was then walking around supermarkets and seeing like cans of baked beans with images from Cars on it, and wondering, you know, what is the correlation between those two things? How do the kids look at that? And does it make them think that the baked beans are going to taste better because it's got an image of the cars on it? I don't know. And I tried asking my 3-year-old, but he was, of course, useless.
as 3-year-olds are.
Why do you want this thing? Right. And they're terrible co-investigators. But on the other hand, they are super interesting too, because they kind of point you towards things you might not otherwise have paid any kind of attention to. And so I became really fascinated about how do these things function in a marketing sense. And I started to think that really what they do is create territories. And the reason I think this is because, like, if you try to, if you watch kids playing with toy versions of cars and so forth, they don't really kind of try to replicate the movie in any kind of way. But they take ideas and almost concepts from the movie, which they then use and recombine in their own kinds of ways. So it seems to me that what's important is that the film somehow creates a kind of territory that their desire can occupy. It's a kind of an imminent space in which cars can talk and cars can do crazy things that they know that they don't do in reality. And this enables them to occupy that space, so that the toys then become kind of props that enable them to create and occupy this space. And that seems to me that's how the advertising works. And I think also what's really interesting is that we tend to, in my view, not pay enough attention to the notion of character. Like, it seems to me character is the formation of a territory. We always think of character in plot terms. But if you talk to people about films, particularly film franchises that they like in my family, like, we're mad fans for the whole Fast and Furious franchise because they're just so super hilarious. And whenever we're driving, we always have this kind of refrain.
Family.
That
family.
If we're going to, right, family, yeah, exactly, that's
family,
part of it.
Family.
But also, what would Dom do in this situation? I was stuck in a traffic jam. What would Dom do? And I always say, I'll just go over the curb and I'll just go up on the footpath and I'll get around these cars. And everybody's like, yep, Dom would do it. But that's extracting notions of character, and it becomes then a kind of a territory that we can occupy, and it becomes a sort of imminent space for the imagination. And I think, to me, that's what's really fascinating. And I think that's why films work. Like, that's why we're interested in them. If you talk to kids and watch them playing out their, you know, various versions of, you know, Frozen or whatever, that's what they take. They don't really give a shit about the storyline. The storyline's fairly immaterial to them. The storyline just creates the occasion for these interesting characters. And what they do is take the characters off on new journeys and new kinds of adventures for them, for themselves. And to me, those are territories. And that's how I try to think about them in the book, as these are territories, and we should be interested in the production of territories, and then ask, well, what kinds of investments of desire do we make into these territories? And, you know, that's, to me, how contemporary popular culture works.
Yeah, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about the cinema books and when Duluth starts talking about the Western. And I was thinking, and when I think of Westerns, has nothing to do with Westerns, actually. I think of the 80s fighting movies, you know, that you have Dolph Lundgren, and then you have Steven Seagal, and then you have Jean-Claude Van Damme. And it's always one person against the world. It's all of these, and, you know, even Sylvester Stallone. And then finally we get this new movie, is it called The Expendables? And they give us a whole montage of just like every single one you grew up with in the 80s with all of these, and they're all doing the same thing. And because the territory of the one person against the world is completely drawn away. So you have all
these people. Just 8 different people acting like individuals, right, against the world. But it is also that, you know, that's the kind of thing we did as kids. Like, as kids, we would say, oh, imagine if, you know, Superman and Batman had a fight, and how would that go? And now we have those movies. Like, it's people who grew up as kids going, what if we did this with that character and did that with that character? And now we're getting the film versions of it, which are always, you know, basically disappointing, because they can never be as good as what we imagined as kids would happen if you were to have Batman versus Superman or whatever. They kind of overlay it with too much adult crap. And not just the pure fun of what those characters themselves might do.
So is this is most of the book this kind of developing through contemporary examples, film? Do you have any other examples you want to throw at us while we close out?
Right. So no, not really. Disappointingly, it's not really a book about popular culture. These are some of the examples that I use. The other example that I use from film is the Denzel Washington character in The Professional, and talk about the way by which his character is created through a set of there's a refrain there of the kinds of character tics. So I say, like, if you want to distinguish between all the various, you know, military trained characters that are revenge oriented, so Liam Neeson in the Taken series and so on, John Wick's
real good.
But what distinguishes them is not their capacity to kill people, because that's more or less, you know, kind of evenly distributed. Rather, what distinguishes them is their kind of mental tics, right? So the Denzel Washington character is always polishing his apples, and he always starts his stopwatch before he starts punching people, and he stops his stopwatch and he's finished punching people.
So in North America, it's called The Equalizer. I think.
Oh, right. I probably got the name wrong, but The Equalizer, yeah.
Yes.
I think the same character back in the day played both. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I probably just got it wrong. But yes, yeah, so those kinds of character traits, like what is the point of those character traits? But clearly they're necessary to distinguish them. Otherwise you just have these kind of inhuman killing machines, because they don't have any particular moral position, et cetera, et cetera. It's all just about revenge and so on. So these character traits are quite important. They really play a very particular kind of role. Which I think we need to begin to think about. And for me, it comes back to this idea of territory, of creating particular kinds of territorial spaces.
So what we could get out of that is these tics differentiate specifically the protagonist as they're a real person. They're not just a killing machine. Whereas everybody that's running up the stairs and getting shot, they don't have any of the, they're not isolated or individuated as a territory. So we have sympathy for one because of the refrain?
Except for the villain. So as Umberto Eco showed with the Bond films, in a very famous essay from the 1970s, you know, he says all the villains in Bond films are sexually aberrant. They all have, you know, these various character traits, in other words, which, you know, people have read to say, well, that this demonizes these various forms of sexuality, which is undoubtedly true. But in terms of how it was, I think, trying to function, it was also trying to say, well, how do we make the villain seem particularly villainous? How do we make them seem, you know, a worthy adversary for what the hero is trying to do? And what kinds of investments of desire can we attract towards it? The other thing that I do say about popular culture in my book, and I guess this is a good one to finish with, I took my kids to Disneyland in Florida in 2017, just at the time when Trump was being inaugurated. So it was a really interesting time to be a kind of, you know, cultural studies critic wandering around America thinking, you know, what the fuck's going on in this country? But what was really interesting to me about Disneyland was this was the new Star Wars park had not yet been built, but it was in the process of being built. But already there were Disney things happening in the park. But what was interesting to me was that the most dominant, most kind of prevalent and pervasive image from the whole Star Wars franchise was the Stormtroopers. Like, I really thought Disney, it would be all about the rebels, that it would be Luke Skywalker and so on and so forth. But no, it was Darth Vader, it was Captain Phasma, it was Stormtroopers. And like every half hour or something, you'd hear that dun, 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 and then have all these Imperial Stormtroopers marching around the park. And to me, at first, this seemed utterly incongruous. And then I thought, but then if you think about it, Trump's about to be inaugurated. What is the most dominant image that America has of itself right now? It's as an empire. Like, it seems to me that it's not actually that surprising that the imperial side of Star Wars should be attracting all this investment of desire, because in the country that is the most powerful empire in known history. And so I think that there's a really interesting thing to be thought about there, because when I was a kid, when Star Wars first came out, there is no way as a kid you would want to wear a Darth Vader mask or a Stormtrooper mask or whatever. You know, those were just absolutely the bad guys. No one, you know, you'd have to take turns at being the bad guy. No one wanted to be a Stormtrooper because, you know, they were terrible. But now, like, that seems to be...
And they can't shoot.
Right, and they can't shoot. Yeah, I think in The Mandalorian, that scene done by Tycho is absolutely brilliant, with these two Stormtroopers are trying to shoot a can or something and they just both keep missing. It's absolutely, you know, it's a brilliant sort of fan-generated kind of moment in film. But, yeah, when I was a kid, like, nobody wanted to be Darth Vader. Nobody wanted to be the bad guy. Everyone wanted to be the rebels. Luke, impossibly, was regarded as a hero that you might want to be. I mean, when you watch Luke now and he seems so whiny, you're kind of like, well, I guess I can see why people would rather be Darth Vader.
I wanted to go to Tosche Station to get to buy some power converters.
he's like ridiculously whiny for this hero. You're like, oh, I'll never get off this island or this planet or whatever. And you just think, oh, you whiny git, how are you going to become a hero? But yeah, this kind of prevalence of the imperial aspects and the dark side and everything, right in the heart of Disneyland, the happiest place on earth, that's meant to be all about American values. To me, that was the image that summed up my trip to the US at that point in time. And I try to say a little bit about that in the book, and probably not enough, but I think there's a whole other project to come back to around this that would be trying to trace the investments of desire in American popular culture.
All right. Well, I think that's a perfect image to end it on, because that can be refrained into people's minds. So that's the book that's coming out this year, September. But if you like listening to Ian, he's got many more books, including the only one I can personally recommend, which is Dilla's on the Internet, plus about, 13 years of journal entries or so?
Longer, if I'm honest.
I mean, of your journal that you're editing.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. It's about that
I
long,
think
yeah.
I saw it was on 13. Anyway, yep. So thank you very much to Ian. Thank you, Chris. And we are going to...
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. This is great.
This was excellent. Ian, as our first celebrity guest, I couldn't be happier. I'm totally thrilled.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you both.
And so, from the Pill Pod, we are out. Goodbye.